obviously very big challenges that we're facing, that this culture is facing: secularization, globalization, digitalization, apathy, you name it. And for some of us, actually, at least I'm inclined for a reaction like this, that might make us lose our hearts. And we might want to say, what is happening to our young people? They disrespect their elders, they disobey their parents, they ignore the law, their morals are decaying. What is to become of them? This is not a quote from an evangelical preacher or a modern sociologist. This is a quote from Plato, 4 centuries before Christ. And we have survived. So this legend of, oh, this difficult young generation has been around for centuries. Wow. We are not the first ones to think like that. The amazing thing is that we follow a God who says something completely different about the young generation. He says this: for I will pour out water on the thirsty land and streams on the dry ground. I will pour out my spirit on your children and my blessing on your descendants. They will spring up like grass in a meadow, like pollard trees by flowing streams. Some will say, I belong to the Lord. Others will call themselves by the name of Jacob. Still others will write on their hand the Lord's and will take the name of Israel. Isn't that an amazingly hopeful perspective on a young generation? What difference does it make, doesn't it, when you follow Jesus? We follow a God who's got a lot of hope and an amazing future for this generation. He utterly, utterly loves Gen Z and Gen Y and however you might call them. He has paid the highest cost for each one of them, and he longs for them much more than any of us longs for them to come to know him. The amazing thing, I think, is we don't follow a God who mourns after the old times, like, oh, it was all so much better back then. But we have a God who's always fresh, he's new, he's got new ideas, and the Holy Spirit, as one of my professors used to put it, is always the youngest among all of us. He's the youngest among all of us. He's the most dynamic. So he's not overwhelmed. He isn't overwhelmed by secularization, by social media, by apathy, nothing like that. And where we see only deserts and problems and challenges, God sees trees by flowing streams. Isn't that an amazing perspective of hope? Yes, there are great challenges, yes, but it's also really, really exciting times. It's times of amazing and unprecedented opportunities. And we are the ones who can step in and stand in the gap and build bridges between the young generation and the gospel. And I think that is a great advantage. So what I want to do with you now is to go through some analysis, cultural analysis, and I've done bits and pieces of that in my session, in the plenary session on Monday, so you might, you know, recognise some of it. And then give you a few ideas. It's more principles. It's not so much hands-on practical stuff, because the application might be really different to you in your different contexts, in your different ministries. So I want to give you some principles. And then in the end, I'm going to say also a little bit about social media and what that brings about. And hopefully we do come to the bit where I do give some ideas, some practical ideas, just from what we have done in our own context. So there we go. All right, so one of the big shifts is that we have gone from a modern mindset to a postmodern mindset. Now, what do I mean by mindset? There's a German philosopher called Heinz-Peter Hempelmann, and he describes a mindset as something that is even bigger, that transcends worldviews. So if a worldview is different countries, you know, and people from different countries, they can, you know, we can hop on a train and go from Germany to Poland, and I can sort of learn the language. We've got a common common language, English, we can understand each other. But and that's different worldviews. But nowadays, he says, we have different mindsets, and that's like living on different continents. So it's not just, you know, a little river that is sort of between our countries, but we have to cross oceans to go from one continent to the other, to go from one mindset to the other. And the mindsets are all centered around the question of truth. How do we get to truth? How do we, what's the source of truth? Now I'm going to explain what I mean. So Hempelmann says, we used to be in a pre-modern area, and in the pre-modern mindset, people believed that there was one truth and that it was very evident what that truth was. It was clear for everyone, here's the one truth. And that means you can't discuss the truth, you can only fight for it. You know, if someone disagrees, you fight for it. And this is, I think, one of the most important things. What's the source of truth? How can we know about truth? In a pre-modern mindset, the way you know what is true and what is right and what is wrong is by authority. In Christian terms, we call that revelation or tradition. We have the scriptures. It's given to us. Truth is something external. It's evident because it's all clearly there. Yeah? So that means it's top down, and it's a society, the society centered around a pre-modern concept of truth. It's quite easy, actually, because everyone is in the same sea of truth, and it's very clear. It's clear what is right and is wrong. That makes it really easy. Today we have quite a few Islamic societies that would still be of a very pre-modern mindset. So you do meet people who have a pre-modern mindset, even in Europe. A lot of immigrants do. And I guess it's fair to say that some very conservative Christian circles also operate on the pre-modern mindset. And then through enlightenment and all of that, we changed more to a modern mindset. The modern mindset says there is one truth. Yes, it's only one truth. But the difference is it's not evident what that truth is. So you need to do research. You need to discuss. You need to do science. That's actually the birth of modern science. We need to strive for truth and come together and discuss this. So the source of truth is no longer, it's written down in scripture or some authority tells me what is right and wrong. The source of truth is now logic and reason. We've got to think about it. See, that's very scientific. You do empirical research. And that means, that's great, we can all sit on the table. We've all done our research. We can sit on the table and discuss. Yeah, and we can discuss in terms that if I disagree with you, we can have a real, you know, real argument about it, but we can still go down to the lobby afterwards and have coffee together or beer, whatever we fancy. Because there's a distinguishment between my opinion and me as a person. And that has been something that has upheld our Western way of reasoning and discussing. That's actually very important for democracy, that there is this distinguishment between the person and their identity and their opinion. So we can agree to disagree. Yeah? That also obviously means that truth is external and it's factual. So we can get that because that's facts. And we can evaluate them. And the question of the modern mindset, the first question they always ask is it true? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very important. And then, fast forward, postmodern mindset. Obviously, postmodern philosophy developed very much after the Second World War. They realized, oh, modernity doesn't deliver, anymore. A lot of disappointment. So postmodern critiques actually said truth claims are always related to claims of power. So whoever claims I have the truth claims I have the power. And then you can see why after the Second World War they didn't want that anymore. So that was questioned. And the postmodern mindset says, yes, there is truth, but it's not just one truth. There are many truths. And then every individual has got their own truth. Because, and that is very important to understand the youth culture, because the way to truth is individual experience. So I perceive what is true by my experience. And then that leads to the fact that we can't come to the table anymore and discuss about truth. Because who are you to tell me that my experience is wrong? And who am I to criticize your experience? We actually can't discuss anymore. Everyone lives on their little truth island, so to say. Yeah? And that also leads to quite a lot of loneliness because there's just no way of communicating anymore. And it is seen as immoral to discuss and to criticize. So can you see this is so important, the big shift. Things that were good in the modern mindset to come together and discuss, for example, are now seen as something immoral. Criticism was okay in the modern mindset because you don't attack me as a person. Now, in the postmodern area, because truth comes through me, it's personal, it's individualized. If you criticize my truth, you criticize me as a person. And that's what they're hearing. You might not want to do that, but that's how it's perceived. So, and that also means that young people, or people of postmodern mindset, as I should say, can hold seeming contradictions together, which is why we also completely need to change our apologetics. When in the past we used to say, oh, you know, but you've got that contradiction, this contradiction, in your worldview, and that might make people change their mindset. No, it doesn't do that anymore. Because it's all through experience, and experience can be really different. So it's okay to have contradictions. Yeah. And obviously, and this is really also very, very important, it's a lot of skepticism towards authority. So here you go. This is really, really interesting. We have, with the gospel, we have a message that was given to us in a pre-modern mindset. I'm not saying it's a pre-modern message because I think the gospel transcends every worldview. It's not one worldview that is more Christian than the other. But it was received in a pre-modern mindset. And then a lot of preacher and youth worker and whatever, people who proclaim the gospel, have been raised in a modern mindset. And we have learned for many centuries how to preach the gospel to a modern mindset, to people who firstly ask, is it true? But now we're suddenly facing all these postmodern people who don't ask the question, what is true? Their question is, what is helpful? Was relevant to me, very pragmatic. And what I often see is that people who preach to young people highly criticize their postmodern mindset, and they try to convert them to modernism before they think they can then convert them to Christians. And I don't think that goes down very well. I don't think that'll work, and I don't think it's necessary. Because as I said, the gospel questions each one of those worldviews, but it also affirms values in each one of those worldviews. I think what we need to learn is to find different ways of connecting, different ways of building bridges. And there are quite a few in the modern mindset, I think. I think that's really important to keep in mind, especially that what serves as credibility in one mindset can also serve as a lack of credibility in the other. So, for instance, I was at the University of Leipzig in Germany with a colleague of mine, and he gave a talk. And I was sitting next to a student and asked him afterwards, what do you think of the talk? And he said, I found it really good. Actually, I'm quite convinced. What I found most convincing was that the speaker, whenever he put forward an argument, so his own argument, something he thought was true, he then also went on to talk about the negative sides of that argument and why you could also question it. He said, that was so convincing for me, because if someone dares to show the weaknesses of their own argument, that means they must be really convinced. And that is convincing for me. You see, for a modern mindset, they would be like, you've got to, you know, put forth your argument and do. No, no, no. The modern mindset, young people, they have a very high value for weakness and for being transparent and for showing your own weaknesses. And to be honest, I think that is a gospel value, isn't it? That is a gospel value that we can affirm. So I think we are not facing what is often called a degradation of values. It's not like, you know, it's all going downhill and the society or the young people have become so immoral. No, no, no. It's a shift of values. It has shifted. Things that used to be regarded as highly moral are now regarded as immoral. And there are reasons to this. And what I think has happened is that we actually have a generation, a young generation, that is highly moral, highly moral. What they have done, from how I would want to see it, is that in many ways they have taken some of the root values of Christianity, like freedom or justice, and then they take those values and draw conclusions from them. But those kind of conclusions are often different than the conclusion that traditional Christianity has drawn. Mm-hmm. So for example, I think it's an amazing thing that this young generation has got this strong, strong hunger for justice. For them, it's all about justice. When I look at the Gospels, Jesus, his big announcement, his mic drop moment in the synagogue of Nazareth, where he announces this is going to be what my ministry is about. What is it all about? Justice. It's justice. You know, I want to free those who are in prison and give sight to the blind and all of that. It's all about justice. So, and then they take this core value of justice and apply it to the marginalized. And among them, women, among them, LGBTQ community and all of that. So then they come to very different conclusions than Christianity has often done. So I think that's something, to be honest, where we need to be honest and learn from them. And then also maybe present a case of why maybe some of these conclusions are not really leading to the same aim, to that common aim that they want. I'm going to come back to that later. So they have a high sensitivity for authenticity and humility, and I think that's a biblical value. And they also, and this is something I've already tackled on, have this really negative view on the abuse of power. Every claim to truth can lead to a claim of power, and then that can very easily lead to an abuse of power. And again, I think that's something what we can learn from. They're very allergic to power play. And for many, to be honest, that's something that they associate with the church. Because power play for that, the postmodern mindset, is also, I tell you how to live and I tell you what is true. Because if I live on my truth island, that's immoral to tell me this is how I should live. So, yeah, there we go. For many, as I said on Monday, for many, especially in the Gen Z and Gen Y, it's become immoral to be Christian. We're not starting from zero when we proclaim the gospel. We're starting from minus 10. As I said on Monday, this can only be a start of a conversation, and then we all need to go home and to do some more thinking and talking. But I do think, as I said on Monday, that I think humility is key. Humility is really, really key. And I think that starts with listening and asking. We really need to become good listeners, because, face it, just because I was a teenager 30 years ago or 25 years ago, that doesn't mean I have any clue whatsoever about what a teenager's lives look like today. I don't know anything about their world. It is a completely different world. And that's a big shift as well. I mean, I think every teenager and every generation felt like this, but I think it's even more true today because of social media. It's just changed so much. We don't have a clue. It's radically different. So we need to be learners. Talk to teenagers. Talk to young people. Ask them all sorts of questions. They are the experts about themselves. And to be honest, if you ask them, if it's genuine questions, they will answer you. Everyone loves to be the expert. So ask them to take you into their world. Can you explain me what is Discord and how do you use this platform? And I ask all these really silly questions, but they love to show me, and then I get ideas and think. And I had this real epiphany moment about how different this is. Just a year ago, I was a Christian, actually the biggest Christian youth festival, it's interdenominational, and I was talking to a 17-year-old girl who was clearly not coming from an evangelical church. And she said to me, "Julia, I learned for the first time today that as a Christian, I shouldn't have sex before marriage. But that is not possible." I was like, "Okay, well." I said, "Why do you think it's not possible?" And she says, "Because there are no men who would ever commit to that. You will never find a man who's going to do that." And turns out she'd had several boyfriends, and she didn't really want to have sex immediately, but they always did. And I think this is also a huge influence of pornography culture, that the guys think, yeah, it's available any time, and the girls think, I've got to make it available any time. So she just didn't have any clue about being able to say no. But then she realized, this is actually hurtful. It's not good for me. It's not what I want to be. So she said, I have actually become a lesbian now. And I have relationships to girls. So suddenly it dawned on me. I was talking to someone who wanted to lead a Christian, non-promiscuous lifestyle. Without knowing it, obviously. But the only way how she knew she could live that lifestyle was by entering into a same-sex relationship. So I asked her, what do you get out of these relationships to girls? And he said, well, it's great. There's always someone there who hugs me, who listens to me, who's just there for me. And again, like, I had my mouth open and thought to myself, this is what I call friendship. And again, it dawned on me that because today every relationship is so sexualized, and the only form of intimacy that we know is sexual intimacy, for her, having a deep relationship where someone would ask how you're doing and be there was immediately a sexual relationship. So the concept of friendship, in a way, didn't exist in her world. And that also, and I'll come back to that, has got to do with social media and how it's a very isolated world in the digital world, and how that makes it very, very hard to form good relationships in the non-digital world. They actually don't know anymore how to form good relationships, or it's become harder. So then I realized, hang on, when I tell them, you know, the Christian way is to not have sex before marriage, or, well, if you feel same-sex attracted, I think you should refrain from practicing your sexuality. What is it that they're actually hearing? What they're hearing is, I'm doomed to be lonely my whole life. I don't have any right to intimate relationships. That is obviously not what we want to say, but that is what they are hearing. And then obviously they say, no, 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 no way. So it's just so different what they're hearing. And obviously they would say, this is immoral of you to say that to me. You're taking away all my rights to relationships, to intimacy. And obviously that is damaging for life, yeah. So I realized her world is just so much more complicated and so different than anything I can imagine in my little Christian bubble. And I also realized I need to start the conversation from a completely different point. And hey, isn't this something amazing where we could actually serve the young generation? Because as Christians, we know a lot about friendship. And, you know, discovering again the theology of friendship and the Bible, I mean, Jonathan and David, that's so much about friendship. Jesus and his friends. But I think that's something we as churches need to rediscover as well, because we have baptized the zeitgeist, and that sometimes I'm a single, so sometimes when I'm at church, it seems like I can't really lead a relationship to God in a proper way and understand what's going on if I'm not married, because also all the examples often come from marriage. So there's a whole back in that, but we could be the light and the salt for this generation if we talked about friendship, if we showed them this is how you can lead deep relationships again. So, oh, by the way, actually, she then went on to talk to me about the love of God in a way that I'd never heard anyone express it before. It was deeply moving for me. And I thought, here's someone, her life is so completely different, but she has grasped something about Jesus that I'd never seen in this way. So again, we can learn from them. So let's ask and listen to know where we can start and how to build bridges to this generation and the gospel. And then part of humility is also to, I think, differentiate and value, as I said, value the gospel-related values that they have. So very often, as Christians, we are very much known for what we are against. I guess most of you know Ned Flanders. If you don't, check out The Simpsons. Ned Flanders is probably the most popular or most well-known Christian in the world because he is the Christian neighbor of The Simpsons. And in one of the episodes, he is asked, Ned, what did you do on the weekend? And his answer is, oh, we went to a Christian camp with my church and we learned how to judge other people well. That is often the view the culture has on Christians. And again, we need to ask ourselves, where does that hold a mirror up to us? Why are we known so much for what we are against? Maybe not so much what we are for. I think, and again, being judgmental is so bad, so immoral in this culture, because again, we have our little truth islands, remember? So criticism that was maybe okay in a modern mindset is highly, highly immoral. How do you dare it in a postmodern mindset? So I think we really need to learn to differentiate well. And I think we're never going to reach this generation if we hold on to stereotypes and generalizations that, to be honest, I often do hear in Christian preaching, because it's quite easy to attack a straw man. And I think sometimes this is the culture and ooh, it's all bad, but no, it's so much more differentiated. So I think that's important for us. And I think what we really need to learn, and I did mention that on Monday, is to look behind the motive of why people are thinking and saying what they are saying. So take, for example, the issue of abortion. Just imagine after ELF, you go home and you sit with some friends, some non-Christian friends in a pub or a cafe place, wherever you are. And because you've just been to ELF and you think, oh, I really want to be... Oh, sorry, and the question of abortion comes up in conversation. And because you have to been to ELF and you really, you know, want to go for it and be a good evangelist or witness for Christ, you say, I am against abortion. What are people going to think about you?
Not going to talk to you anymore.
Yeah, why?
Because you shut me off.
You shut me off, yeah. Wild. What are they going to think about how I am if I say something like this?
Judgmental Christian.
Yeah? Judgmental, yeah. Sorry?
Yeah, not to be taken seriously.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm old-fashioned, I'm anti-women. Yeah, all of that. And then because you really, really want to go for it, you say, well, actually, I'm against abortion because I'm a Christian and I think God thinks the same. What are people going to think about God?
They will reinforce their belief, their disbelief.
Yeah, well, the same thing. They're going to think God is judgmental, he's outdated, he's anti-women, all of that. So instead of being an amazing witness for Christ, you've actually made the gap much deeper. The problem is, it was the right question, but it was the right answer, but it was a different question behind the question. Because behind the question of abortion, for many Christians, there's the question of the value of life. But to be honest, the young generation, most of our contemporaries, would affirm that, yes, life is worth anything and everything. I mean, in the West, we spend thousands of euros on a cancer operation just for one person. They have a high value of life. But the question behind the question of abortion for most people in our society, and especially young people, is the question of freedom of women. So what they're hearing when I'm denying abortion is I'm against the freedom of women. To be honest, that's not me. And I think that's not Jesus. I mean, Jesus championed women. He was all for women and women's rights. So I think it's important we see what is the good aim behind what they are saying. And if it is freedom of women, okay, great. We're in the same boat. We've got the same aim. And then let's discuss what is the best way towards that aim. And why do we think that Jesus, that the good news, is actually good news for the freedom of women? And I did mention some of that on Monday, how research has been done that the promiscuous lifestyle of our culture is actually, in many ways, anti-women. So I'm not going to go into that deeper. And you can take every opinion that's out there and do that same exercise. And I think it's really, really important that we do that and understand, and then we can value. And we will criticize the right things, and we can build bridges to the gospel. So the third thing, and that goes with humility as well, is I think humor is really key. it's really good to be able to laugh about ourselves. Not humour towards minorities and other people or at their expense, but let's laugh about ourselves. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to laugh about, Christians. and humour brings a light touch to everything. And then I think what is really, really key as well is dialogue. As we said, this is a generation that dislikes being told things top down. And to be honest, most of the stuff we do at church doesn't go down well because it's, to be honest, mainly men standing in front of an audience and preaching. And that is not a format that goes down really well in this generation. One, because you know, they're used to having dialogue, they're used to voicing their own opinions, they're used to being asked. And again, it affirms this top-down thing that is just not part of their worldview. And the dialogue is something I think is amazing. It's a real, really something we should immerse, I think. We have developed a dialogue method for proclamation. And we're using that a lot with young people, evangelistically, but then also with Christians. But actually, to be honest, we're also using this a lot with adults, and they love it as well. So it goes like this. You have a topic, for example, meaning of life. You do a little introduction where you bring up the topic, and then you connect it and say, well, meaning of life, aren't we all searching for it? Well, tonight I want to look at a short story of someone who also had that longing for meaning in life, and they met someone who told them about the meaning of life. And then I read, the story of Jesus meeting the women at the well, whatever text you chose. And then everyone has got a Bible in front of them, and they can read the text for themselves for a few minutes. And then they get into little groups, like you just did, and they bring up a question. So the task is, if you read the text, what is the first question or the most important question that comes up? And then everyone gets to share that question. That is particularly hard for the Christians because they're used to having maybe a non-Christian sharing that question, and then all the Christians jump on the question, try to explain and preach. No, that's not what we do. We share the question. And then they can come up with one question in their group. And my preaching or my proclamation of the gospel is that for 20 minutes, I try and answer the life questions of the audience. And that brings in a little insecurity for the preacher as well. And they love that. and it's actually them who are then able to sort of tell me what I should talk about. It takes a lot of preparation. It really does, because you need to be thinking of all these questions and try and find answer. And then at the end, I've got like 5 minutes or 6 minutes to come up with one, here's my one thought that I want to give away, and then I can wrap it up. We've seen this working really well, both in the evangelistic context, but also amongst Christians. And this is something that we need to, I think, incorporate much more in our youth work. How can we come up with different models of dialogue? So I'm just very quickly running you through some stuff about social media. Obviously, another big, big shift is social media or media, the internet. And here are some figures. This is for the German-speaking context, but I guess it might be similar in your context. So young people in Germany today spend 4 hours and 44 minutes daily on digital media. That is 32 hours a week. Let that sink in. I would say it's more as well. But that was the studies that I found. But for most of them, I would think it's more. And I am, so one of the teenagers I'm talking to quite a lot, she's good at cultural analysis. She tells me a lot of my friends are on YouTube 7 or 8 hours a day. And they go to school. They go to school for 7 hours a day. So I'm like, when are they actually, how do they fit this in? And she says, well, they stay awake a lot. Many of them don't sleep. And we see this huge mental crisis as well. And obviously that's multifaceted, the reasons for it. But I thought, if that's the level of lack of sleep when you're 14, 15, 16, whoa, that's not going to be good for your brain, for your mental health. So again, 88%, that's what the study from 2022 showed of young people aged 14 to 29 use social media at least once a week. I don't know about the 12 other percent. I haven't met them. But yeah, that's a study. And in my context, most young people, so Instagram is the most important platform. Instagram is a community platform. That means you sort of stay in your own bubble. So what the algorithm gives to you is more of the same. So you like certain influencer, you like certain people of a different opinion, of some opinion, and then it shows you more of the same. So you always fed by what you like. And that then creates those bubbles and echo rooms. Yeah. TikTok. TikTok is really on the rise. So I would think that by now TikTok is used more than Snapchat. TikTok is not a community platform, it's a content platform. And that means it just dashes stuff out on you. The algorithm is designed to keep you in the loop. I mean, that's the case with all of these algorithms. And then we complain about the young people being addicted to this stuff, when it was actually our generation that has created and written those algorithms. And it's hard for some of us to resist. How should a young person resist? They're all made, it's all about money. They are made to keep you in the loop. They are made on purpose to make you addicted. And what TikTok does is it gives you a reel of a cat and then bombs in Syria or Ukraine and then sports. So can you see, I mean, we all know this, what that does to our brains. But what about a brain of a young person that is just developing? And I think it also creates this lack of empathy because, you know, in between my cat and my football video, I see a bomb as well. So there's so many things that are related to this. But it's also fair to say, to be honest, we need to be there. I don't like this. I don't like social media at all. I resisted Facebook. It was not a big temptation for me. Then I had to go on Instagram because of my job. and I realized this is a really dark world for me. We need the gospel there. We need to be there. And if it's not us, then we need to empower and disciple others to be there, to bring the gospel into these spheres. And TikTok's got especially such an evangelistic opportunity because it's very random. So you don't need a lot of followers in order for a video to go viral because the algorithm that just gives it to everyone and anyone. So it's a huge, huge evangelistic opportunity. Well, you get 30 seconds, but it is. So if we want to be a Jew to the Jew, a Greek to the Greek, a digital learner in my case, to the digital natives, we need to be there. It's what Luke told us about, don't wait for them to come to you, go to them. That is also something very important that we have realized. It's always a new platform coming, so we need people, we need to train evangelists and social youth worker who are ready to observe the culture and then hop on to the next platform because that's where everyone is going. So what does that mean? I mean, all sorts of things, but a few things I wanted to point out to you. So for this young generation, the non-digital and the digital world merge. It's become one. There's no separation anymore. And that, again, makes their world so different to ours. And that also has all sorts of consequences. One of them is that it's really destabilizing for mental health. It really is. And that's what churches have to deal with, youth workers. We just had this digital event, and we gave people the opportunity to respond via Instagram. We had 1,200 teenagers writing into us and reporting about all sorts of mental illnesses. So it was not just, you know, back in my times, people were bullied and that was really bad, and it is. But what these teenagers are reporting is depression, anxiety, a lot of suicidal thoughts. I mean, suicide rates are just cracking. Rape as well. And very often they said, we have never told anyone before. It's only in this digital space that I have the freedom to tell anyone, tell you now. So again, as churches, I think we need to be thinking, how can we serve this young generation? We're quite good at this. We're good at counseling, and maybe we can become better. But how can we serve, go into their space, be there to listen? Very often, they don't have anyone in the non-digital world that listens to them. And yeah, it's just such a huge need. This also means that many of them spend more time with influencers than with their friends. So it really, as I said, impacts the way how they lead relationship. I have a few friends who have teenage daughters, and they tell me, my daughter, she doesn't meet her friends anymore. She doesn't go out with them. She just sits in her room, and they are on WhatsApp and Instagram and all of that. And I mentor a 16-year-old, and she says, my friend, they don't want to meet. I'd love to meet up with them, but they don't. So again, that creates this sense of loneliness. Yes, they're all interconnected via digital media, but that, it's not the same. We've all seen that during the pandemic. It's great to have Zoom calls, but it's much better. There's something about the physical that is really, really good for our souls and our hearts. But many of them, don't get that a lot anymore. And that also makes it so much harder for youth groups together. I don't know about your context, but I hear a lot from youth group leaders. They just don't come anymore. And obviously, again, all sorts of different reasons, but social media is one of them. It's just more attractive to sit on TikTok and be filled with all this stuff. And again, it's dopamine. Is that how you call it? Yeah, dopamine. It's so much more exciting. It's boring, but it's more exciting, and the dopamine raises so much more of you on TikTok rather than sitting in your youth club and having a piece of cake. First impression. And then obviously that also means that there is a huge shift in whom teenagers regard as authority. Influencers are the new priests of this generation. They will not, if the Christian teenagers will not ask their youth pastor for advice, they will ask Pastor Google for advice. And many of them now are churched by global churches. And so again, this is a huge, huge challenge for the local church. It also means that, at least in my context, I don't know about you, but your context, but we do have a few Christian influencers. But all of them, most of them, are really, really young. And they don't have any theological education whatsoever. But very often, they are the biggest theological influence on our teenagers. And I'm like, ooh, when I see the stuff, it's so shallow. It's really shallow. So we have been thinking now, how can we serve the Christian influencers? How can we gather them? How can we teach them theologically? How can we come alongside them? And it's different. You can't put on a scheme, like a training scheme of a year, and they go through it. No, they're not going to do that. It's got to be personal, I feel. I'm in touch with a few influencers and really try to walk alongside and try to invest in them, because I know what they're going to put out on social is going to reach so many people. So maybe for some of us, that needs to become our ministry, to walk alongside influencers. They're often really lost because they're so young, and then all of a sudden there's all this fame. And that's not just non-Christian, that is also Christian influencers, at least in my context. So again, that's a completely new form of ministry. But social media, and that's so important, is is the modern marketplace, so we have to be there. Reluctantly, in my case. And maybe I'm not the right person, and that's okay, but be thinking about how can we as Christians, how can we as church be there?